Welcome to the Gemini Podcast, my lovely little astro babes. I am Shade the Mad, daughter of Mercury and the Gemini part of this podcast. With me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Alice Allister. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Shade, and hello, listeners. Happy belated solstice.
Yay, it's summertime, my probably least favorite holiday. season. I'm just going to come right out and say it. Everybody loves to say that they love when summertime comes around, but that's bullshit. People who like hot, sweaty, sticky, miserable weather that makes it just as terrible to go outside as, like, cold, snowy, frozen wasteland, y'all are full of shit.
You know, I'm right there with you. I'm very much about the transitory seasons myself, and especially given that, it's been hot as fuck here in Denver, like, unpleasantly so.
Yeah. Well, speaking of transitory seasons, it is Cancer season, and that means that we have completed one full cycle, or we're about to, I guess. Complete one full cycle through one quadrant of the zodiac. And Alice is going to walk us through what we've already experienced and give us just a quick little recap of what we've already been through this year.
Thus far, we have explored our first fire sign, our first cardinal fire sign with Aries, moving into our first fixed Earth sign with Taurus, and our first mutable air sign with Gemini. So remembering the whole cardinal, fixed, mutable thing, there's three modalities that make a completion in themselves. And then the elemental factor, fire, earth, air, and now water. So you think about it, you know, this whole three against four, three times four thing comes up in a lot of different ways, and, like, that is our zodiac. That three times four equals 12 signs and all of that. So now that we're moving into Cancer season, we get the first cardinal water sign. First water sign, but second cardinal sign in what we've explored so far. So this is moving into this is the completion of the first quadrant of our signs, basically. And so this is really, like, the most sort of inner and personal, archetypes of the zodiac, whereas, like, Cancer can really be seen as the turning point of, well, things get murky in a lot of different ways. Like, if you look at Gemini, you can have a conversation with yourself, but usually there's still other people involved. So maybe that one was really the first transition into, like, transition away from strictly self and a little bit more of others. Cancer just deepens things and adds so many layers of complexity.
Yeah, that's for sure. Cancer is deep, deep, deep. Where Gemini likes to sort of flit above the clouds, above the flower petals, Cancer likes to dive down and there's a lot to be said about the crab symbolism behind Cancers. And I'm sure we're gonna get into a little bit of that, but I had a great time, you know, delving into Cancer season and personality types and what the Cancer experiences really, what it feels like, I guess. I feel like that's the most appropriate way to say it when we're talking about people who rely so heavily on emotion and feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Shade, if you wouldn't mind giving us some of the common keywords associated with cancer, that could be a good place to start, because everything that we're going to say in this episode, we can try to relate back to some of these, like, little kernels of conceptual experience or feeling or whatever.
Sure. So, I read about three different sources that are fairly comprehensive in terms of each zodiac sign's experience, and these are the words that sort of kept sticking out to me: intuitive, emotional, manipulative, persuasive, charismatic, home, security, sentimental, aggressive, imaginative, moody, and argumentative.
That is very interesting. There's most of those are like, oh yeah, that's bread and butter, cancer, you know, like stereotype 101 sort of stuff. And yet I am the most curious about charismatic popping up in there, and argumentative and aggressive. I mean, like, to a lesser extent, those last two, like, I could feel those being a part of some other, like, you know, branch of the crab claw that just makes sense. But the charismatic one, that's the one that I'm going to be chewing on for a while.
You don't, in your experience, most cancers aren't charismatic people?
Well, oh boy. That's going to spiral out real quickly, but in a nutshell, or a crab shell, as the case may be, we're talking about an archetype that is, like, if we look at the shell right away, and we look at not just crabs, but, like, shelled creatures besides crabs, because before Cancer was the crab, Cancer was a turtle. So you've got another creature that lives in this protective, hard outer exterior, and all of the tender, sensitive parts on the inside are hidden, essentially. And it's this sort of, like, protective thing. And so I guess on the one hand, it's more common, maybe, or it's more stereotypical, at least, to assume that people with cancer placements are more to themselves, more private, less, giving of those sort of deeper elements of themselves. But at the same time, considering Cancer and Capricorn and how similar they are in that sort of way, it's like, maybe that charisma is coming from this sort of, like, projected self. Whether or not that's, like, an authentic self that's really coming out of the shell, because that is really the heart of the cancer process, like, coming out of the shell in safe ways, you know? Sure. It's not, like, just ripping the shell off and, like, saying, here I am! Like, come and eat me! It's a process of slowly opening the shell and letting the tender parts out in a way that isn't dangerous necessarily. That's food for thought for all of us, hopefully.
Yeah. I think in the context that I kept in my understanding of Cancer's supposed charismatic nature, it stood more for Cancer's ability to anticipate and pick up on other people's needs and fulfill those needs. And so people get drawn to Cancers naturally. They have this magnetism about them. And it maybe sort of comes off as charisma. They have this, like, sort of quiet, witty nature about them, or, like, they often have different viewpoints in life that intrigue people, so they come across as very charismatic because they're you know, unique in that way.
I like that. I like that a lot. That's that feels a lot more on point. And when we get into part two, we're going to have some really interesting cancer example people to talk about. I promise you that.
Yes, we will.
I guess amongst those keywords, home and security and the fact that we already started talking about the shell, like that's a place that I want to like maybe start and bring back just a little bit for a second, because home and nurturing are like two of the biggest elements of the cancer process, the cancer experience. And strictly from a symbolic perspective, like we're talking about the most primordial home, the womb, and the nourishing function that the womb provides in any creature that has a womb.
Sure. Yeah.
It is the first shell, and it is the first nourishing presence that any life form, well, there's probably other life forms that are life forms that don't really do that thing. I mean, fungus? They spore and they turn into mycelium, so I guess they don't really have a womb. But whatever. Anyhow, like, we're thinking about all of the things that are associated with, like, the ideal home. It is a comfortable, safe place where you can kind of let your guard down. Maybe, you know, drawing on the platitude, a house is not a home. Just because you have a place that is a structure in which you live, it doesn't necessarily give you that comfort and nourishment and, like, all of the things that make home feel like home, including maybe history and pictures of your ancestors and a family. 'Cause family and ancestry and, like, the creation of homes that feel like homes, that's all so much a part of the cancer process.
Yeah, that's, I love that. That was not something that I had really encountered in any of my reading, that, like, emphasis on the womb, or I did read a little bit about how sentimental cancer can be when it comes to trinkets or knickknacks or photos and that kind of stuff, like maintaining some sort of history. Like, they are more prone to, you know, like, whatever they have, in no way do they consider it junk. It is never junk. Everything means something to a cancer. So, like, that's, I love that. I love how, I don't know, just, like, deep and thoughtful and sentimental that all feels compared to everything else that we've talked about so far. You have these materialistic comforts that Taurus seeks, you know, you have Gemini that is just, like, desperately seeking experience, you know, Aries just having that, like, firecracker energy and not really being able to focus for too long on any one thing. Cancer is, like, one of the things that I really loved the most when I was reading about the symbology behind the crab was, like, how they pointed out that the crab can, you know, live and survive on both land and in the sea, and in fact relies on that, you know, that state of existence. And that is very much a cancer trait where, you know, they are capable of living life on the surface and, you know, just like being a part of the environment around them, but they're like most at home, you know, in their own shell in the sea where it's deep and dark and quiet and, you know, thoughtful and, dreamy. And, you know, there's a ton of wonderful, beautiful imagery behind cancer.
I fucking love that you highlighted the fact that the crab and turtles as well, like, by extension, are creatures right. that can be underwater creatures and can be land creatures. And, you know, like, maybe one side of that is a little bit out of the element compared to the other, but bringing back that polarity thing, because the polarities are one of the things I will never stop emphasizing, because they're so fucking cool, and you start to see how similar opposing signs are. What is Capricorn but a sea goat? It is both the goat that ascends the mountain and also half fucking mer person and is able to impossibly traverse the ocean as well.
Yep. Yeah, I can't wait to get into the mythos behind the sea goat.
That's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah.
I also love that you brought up all of the sentimentality and the first time that we're seeing this sort of emotional engagement with things compared to the previous signs. On the one hand, all of that feels like very much the sorts of concerns and like personality type that would benefit anyone in a caretaking position. Any loving parent, regardless of gender, any like caring caretaker or healer, because cancers are often associated with roles of healing and just caring for other living things and caring for oneself as well. Beyond that, it's like there's a dimension of cancer that, like, I don't know how to articulate where this fits into kind of like the cell that is all of these different traits right now, like whether this is the nucleus maybe or some other, like, maybe this is the cytoplasmic fluid that just brings it all together. But that sentimentality, that sensitivity, we can say it probably relates to that soft, gooey, inner, like, thing that's hiding inside of the shell. And exploring that just a little bit, like, cancer can represent some really intense, deep and private identity. Again, we're thinking about all of the symbolism of the shell and home and, like, how all of these things are private places and secure places and places that the rest of the public world don't necessarily get to see. You have to let someone into your house. You have to let someone into your shell. And if we start to bring in this idea that family exists in our homes, and we as young people are so deeply shaped by whoever it is around us that we spend that much time with, whether or not it's biological family, chosen family, unrelated persons, whatever. Like, the sorts of myths and, like, dreams and feelings that we think in the privacy of our own minds, so much of those are informed by the messages we get from our home environment, what our parents say about us, what our parents feel about us, how our parents or whoever in the home treats us. And so there's this interesting sort of two-way, I guess, that exists in this potential for being a healer and a caretaker on that cancer side of things, where any cancer placement is called to do some exploration of one's own deep inner self as well, to understand what's going on in there. And I'm tempted to say that's almost like a prerequisite to being a good healer for anybody else or a good caretaker for anybody else. Tempted, and on some layer, I think that's probably ultimately true. But one of cancer's biggest pitfalls, not to skip too far ahead into episode two, but like, cancer can just as easily spend so much time taking care of everybody else that they don't take care of their own needs. Like, that can become a little bit of a defense mechanism.
Yeah, I have read that too. I've heard or read that cancer can become prone to martyrdom, and not in the same sense that, like when we talked about Donald Trump and his like temperamental Leo placements and how that can kind of become, you know, oh, you guys are so mean to me. Why do you treat me like this? Whereas cancer is actually martyring themselves for the ones that they love, for the people around them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that comes back a little bit to the keyword you mentioned with like the particular manipulative quality of cancer, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a lot of manipulative parents out there, and a lot of them will pull that particular martyrdom card. Just saying.
Yes, that is true. I mean, the manipulative aspect, that really kept sort of being portrayed in the context of cancer's ability to pick up on other people's emotions and like their own emotional landscape is constantly shifting with, you know, the tide, basically. It's, you know, whoever's around them is affecting how they are feeling. They pick up on that intuitively. Mm-hmm. And if they become, you know, well practiced at it or gain confidence in that arena, then they can absolutely pick up on other people's emotions and use those emotions against them. They know when you're feeling vulnerable. They know when you're angry or sad, or, you know, they know just that right moment when to ask you for permission to do something that you otherwise probably would say no to, you know?
Yeah, I can totally see that. And it's interesting contrasting, since we spent some time talking about how Gemini's manipulative power lies in sort of like the slickness of words and like, you know, maybe lies by omission or spinning up, like creating a spin or something like that. It's all very heady stuff. This is, you know, now that we moved into water territory, everything that you're saying is like, oh, different flavors of manipulation. It's not limited to any one sign. It just, the method changes a bit.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Cancer, as far as I can tell, they choose to let feelings be their guide and prefer to use instinct, instead of impulse, to, you know, make decisions. I mean, those are all pretty reliable traits and characteristics, I think, that seem pretty basic, like cancer level traits, you know? But yeah, I don't know. It's what fascinating creatures the crab turned out to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, since we just focused on a little bit of maybe the negative side, like putting back the positive potentials, like that intuition and that sensitivity to others' feelings and stuff like that, again, makes them potentially the perfect healers, you know?
Yeah. I read an article that was talking about how often cancer finds themselves in positions where people come to them for advice or for guidance, that kind of thing. And how a lot of times, cancer, when they withdraw into their shells, it can be really sudden or like off-putting for the people that have come to rely on them for that guidance and for that support. And that seems to be one of those things that people who are like in relationships with cancers suffer from a lot, is like once they've been slighted, once cancer feels slighted or offended or, you know, they retreat into themselves, and the people around them absolutely feel that absence in their lives. Cancer has the ability to affect the people around them very, very greatly. So yeah, something to watch out for if you're in love with a crab.
And in love with the cap, too. It's one of those things. I mean, it's between Cancer and Capricorn, they're both such past-oriented signs, but in such different ways, you know? And while Cancer, when hurt, would respond with that exactly how you were saying there, and kind of shut off, you know, maybe Capricorn wants to pretend, oh yeah, I don't have feelings, you can't hurt me, but deep down inside, actually, there's a lot of boo-hooing happening. Sure. We just don't want to show it.
Yeah. God, Capricorn's a dick.
Yep.
Stubborn bastards. Okay. Well, so, you know, one of the things that I so often run into when, like, people talk about the Zodiac and whatnot is, like, people who haven't taken the time to delve into, like, what Cancer is or what it means or why it's a crab or anything like that, you know, there's this stigma attached to it because of, you know, Cancer is also a disease. It's a terrible, deadly disease that takes many, many lives and, you know, sounds horrible. And then, like, people think of the crab and it's like, ew, why does it have to be a crab? You know, it's like, when's your birthday? And they're like, it's in July. I'm a Cancer. I'm like, okay, cool. What's wrong with that? And they're like, it just sounds terrible, Cancer. I mean, gosh.
Like, to be fair, like, Cancer etymologically means crab. So, however, Cancer, the word, became about, you know, cells doing crazy shit and wreaking havoc on your body. That's kind of mysterious to me because the word Cancer has its origin as meaning the crab.
Well, funny you should mention that, because I happen to have noted that you are correct. It is Latin for crab, but it was named the cancer, the medical condition, was named that because, like, doctors way, way back in, like, the 17th century were looking at tumors that had swollen veins, and the veins seemed to resemble the legs and limbs of a crab, so they decided to call it Cancer.
Womp womp. Damn you, 1700s doctors.
I know. Terrible. But there you have it. Mystery solved. Anyways, I do want to talk just briefly about the mythos behind the constellation Cancer. It is kind of a sad, twisted, cute little story. It all began a long, long time ago in ancient Greece with a man called Hercules. Actually, technically...
Hercules, you say.
Yes. Actually, it technically started with Zeus and his dirty, dirty wiener not being able to resist the pull of a mortal woman. Zeus had an affair, king of the gods, had an affair with a woman named Alcmene, and Hera tried to punish Hercules, the spawn of Zeus and Alcmene. He was not the, like, saint that Disney wanted us to believe that he was.
As is often the case with Disney.
Right. Hercules actually killed his music teacher with a lyre.
Shit. Shit. Oh, wow. That hits home. Please, none of my students ever kill me with an instrument.
A tale for another day, I suppose. As punishment, he was sent to tend cattle in the mountains, and while he was there, he fell in love with Megara. And later, he married her, went on to have children with her, and Hera, seeing all of this, was pissed. So, she crept her way into Hercules' mind and whispered into his mind for days and days on end until he went mad and slaughtered his whole family. As punishment for this crime, he was assigned 12 labors, known as the 12 labors of Hercules. And the second was to kill the 9-headed Hydra, which hopefully everybody is familiar with the Hydra. Once you cut off one head, another one grows back. The middle one is immortal. It was a fierce battle, and Hercules came up with the idea to set the Hydra on fire. So when Hera, who was watching this battle, saw that Hercules was gaining ground, she sent a giant crab to try and help the Hydra kill Hercules. But Hercules crushed the crab under his mighty foot, and the crab died. So Hera felt bad for the crab's sacrifice, and turned him into the constellation Cancer.
We've had some wild origin stories so far, but like I feel like that one is just, there is so many interesting things going on there, and like people getting the short end of the stick in just odd ways.
I know. You know, you don't mess with Hera. You know, hell hath no fury.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty fucking savage. Like, as soon as you talked about, you know, like, whispering in Hercules' ear and, like, convincing him to kill his family, like, of course, the first place my mind goes as a person living in the 21st century in America is, like, all of the stories of parents who heard God tell them to kill their children or whatever, and, like, that's... Sure. For that to have gone down, and then, like, the Hydra, and then the crab, and then, oh, well, I felt bad about the crab, so. Wow.
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, maybe don't feel so bad. Once you know the history behind Cancer and the crab and the constellation, it makes it better, makes it more exciting. It's a little more swashbuckling. To cover is we kind of talked about it a little bit, but we didn't really say it outright. The ruling planet, quote unquote, for Cancer is the moon, understandably. You know, we're talking about the first water sign, the moon being, you know, most, it's like one of the first things that everybody learns in school in terms of how the moon can affect the tides, and, I mean, not can, but does. It does affect the tides. And ocean currents, too? Is that accurate?
Maybe. I'm out of the loop there.
All right, well, we are not maritimers. We're not, my brain keeps wanting to say microbiologist, but it's not a microbiologist. Marine biologist.
Yeah, maybe oceanographers.
Yeah, there you go. this is why we do zodiac stuff and star stuff.
I really like that you mentioned the moon, just because it dawned on me like last night or the night before when I was trying to fall asleep and couldn't fall asleep that the summer solstice, the peak of day energy, the longest day of the year, is the beginning of Cancer, the sign ruled by the moon. Not Leo, the sign ruled by the sun. So it's just interesting to me that, like, there is that kind of, like, reversal or ambiguity or, like, mismatch, or maybe on some deeper or higher level there is, like, harmony that I'm just too dumb to see, but
yeah,
just food for thought.
You know, that makes me think, I don't know why, but, like, we're not going to talk about myth, like, moon mythos this episode, but, like, I was looking and reading a bunch of tales and legends and myths associated with the moon, like, just different, what different cultures believe about the moon and how, you know, like, I read the story about where the rumor that the moon was made of cheese originated from, which is kind of a cute story. It's kind of cute and sad, but anyways, one of the things that I noticed was that in a lot of cultures around the world, the moon is associated with a male type energy, and the sun is a woman's energy, which is very opposite what the zodiac tries to portray or often talks about. I mean, I know we're breaking away from gender stereotypes ourselves, but I only say that because there's so often tales and legends that involve both of them. And I just thought it was interesting. Like, you can't have one without the other, it seems like, across the globe. No matter what region of the world you're talking about, a lot of myths, the whatever the story behind the moon is, involves the sun somehow. And but, like, so often I just was surprised that so many other cultures define the moon as being, like, a god, and the sun being a goddess or some, you know, like, spirit that is a man and spirit that is a woman, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, that's, I don't know, just awesome.
Yeah, just some kind of balance there. I don't know, just some sort of balancing yin-yang kind of energy there for the summer solstice and the moon.
Sweet.
Yeah. So, speaking of the moon, we're going to go down the rabbit hole in a segment that I call Moon Madness.
I'm sorry. The first place my mind goes with that is I just want to have an Instagram or Twitter feed that is exclusively pictures of people mooning me.
You know, that did not come up in my research. I have no idea why people call it mooning when they're flashing their naked bum.
Oh, when the moon hits your eye. No, okay.
Okay.
Tell us about this madness.
Yes. Well, do people really go mad when there's a full moon? Can the moon affect us physiologically? Well, according to some sources and certain studies that have been done, I would say yes. I would say that is a legitimate thing that happens. There was a study published in the Indian Journal of Basic and Applied Medical Research that found that when exercising, your heart is at its peak performance during a full moon.
Whoa. Cool.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, even if you're just going to the gym once a month, I mean, that's probably fine. Just plan it during the full moon.
There you go. Work smart, not hard.
There you go. That's right. Also, much like the moon controls the ebb and flow of the tides, our brains are composed of a significant amount of water. I think it's something like 70% water or something like that. Maybe even more than that. There are certain researchers that hypothesize that the moon's gravitational pull could similarly have an effect on our brains, causing erratic behavior. There were other studies done by British scientists that reveal that a full moon may actually decrease seizure activity in epileptics.
Oh, wow. Cool. I'd never heard of any of these things.
Yeah. There was also a 2011 study published in the Journal of Urology that found kidney stone pain increased significantly during a full moon. And another study done by English researchers found that, in general, more patients were admitted to hospitals with urological emergencies during a full moon as well.
Neat.
Japanese researchers discovered something interesting when they discovered that there's a significant increase in the number of births when the gravitation of the moon to the Earth is at its most powerful. And for some reason, an Italian study examined more than 1,200,000 births over 3 years and found that a higher number of babies are born in the 2 days after a full moon.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah. I got two more for you.
Oh, boy. All right.
There was a 2011 study published in the World Journal of Surgery that found that 40% of medical personnel believe in full moon madness. They revealed that emergency calls for all sorts of conditions increase by 3% when there's a full moon, and then drop by 6% when there's a new moon.
Whoa! Okay, that's extra cool that there's, like, the comparison between full and new.
Yeah, yeah. And last but not least, in 2008, British researchers found a link between the lunar cycle and what doctors call medically unexplained stroke symptoms, where patients develop complaints such as headaches, numbness, and coordination issues, but have nothing physically wrong with them.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a scientist or a researcher, but, you know, it seems like plenty of people have done the legwork and the heavy lifting on this, and I have to say, I'm pretty convinced that the full moon does, in some way, for some reason, have an effect on our existence, even if we're not living near the ocean.
Yeah. Damn, that's a lot of articles that need to go on my reading list, and I'm mad about that because my reading list is already too long, but holy shit, that is fascinating. That is cool as fuck.
I mean, you certainly could. Maybe you just, like, need to prioritize your reading list by season, so when it's cancer season, you read all your moon articles.
That's a good idea. I gotta figure out, I'm just hesitant to prioritize all of my revolutionary reading until Aquarius season rolls around again, because that's kind of what's at the top of my list right now.
All right, that's fair. You're trying to save the world. I'll give you a pass. I'll allow it.
You'll thank me later.
I hope so.
I do too. So do we have some words of the day?
Oh, do we have some words of the day? I have words of the day for you.
Words for days.
Yes. So, I don't know how many people are aware, but I live in the lovely state of Wisconsin, and in Wisconsin, we have a very rich history with Native American culture. I say we, but I'm no Wisconsinite. I am a Coloradan still, through and through. But, you know, I have to say, Wisconsin has it. Wisconsin wins, hands down, the name game. We have so many cool-ass, just, like, fun-sounding cities and towns in this place. I have a small sampling for you. They are all Native American in origin, and they're wonderful to say. First of all, we'll start with the place where I live, in Waukesha. Waukesha is a Chippewa word, and it means little fox.
Oh, cute.
Yes. Next, we have Oconomowoc. The town of Oconomowoc gets its name from the Ho-Chunk tribe, and it means waterfall or river of lakes.
Sweet, sweet.
Next we have McWanago. McWanago is from the Potawatomi tribe. Do you see what I mean? These are so much fun.
Yes.
McWanago means place of the bear. And then we have Muskego, which is another Potawatomi Indian name for sunfish, which is, there's like a bunch of lakes and rivers and stuff in Muskego. It's mostly water, in fact, in that region, and they have a lot of sunfish there, I guess. And last but not least, the one that most people probably know without really knowing that they know, either because of Charlie Barron's and the Manitowoc Minute, or because of the Making a Murder documentary series. Manitowoc is a Ojibwe word that can mean it means somewhere in the realm of dwelling of the Great Spirit, or spirit land, or spirit woods, something of that translation.
So that's like extra sacred.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So Waukesha, Oconomowoc, McWanago, Muskego, and Manitowoc.
Yeah.
Plus Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, and Ojibwe, and Chippewa.
Yeah, it's amazing, all of these different indigenous cultures and their, like, languages, and of course it bears saying, like, we're all settlers on these lands, and hopefully the forces of justice, cosmic justice, will bring harmony back to these lands.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. You know, this is like, this will be sort of a good tie-in, I guess, to one of my plugs. But at my house in my backyard, we had a huge fairy tree, which is, it's like a tree that had one trunk, and that trunk split into, like, maybe, like, 4 feet up, it split into, like, 7 different trunks.
Wow.
And, yeah. And the thing was massive, but our landlord decided that he wants to put in a patio in the back, and so a few days ago he had a tree cutting service come and cut the whole tree down, except for they didn't take the tree with them. I just have a cut-up tree in my backyard. I have no backyard right now. It's just full of dead tree now. And I was really feeling sad about it. I mean, like, I know we were feeling, like, collectively as a family, we were feeling kind of sad about it because, you know, we have a nice backyard. It was a pleasant way to spend an evening or an afternoon playing in the backyard. The tree itself was lovely. It was tall and offered wonderful shade. But, like, I was feeling so much sadness on a deeper level about this wonderful living thing that had been around in the world, offering its shade and its oxygen, you know, and food and shelter for animals for years, that is now dead and gone and cut into, 100 different pieces. And I had been reading this book, and it explored a little bit of some of the Native American beliefs behind cutting plants and, or, you know, killing animals and, you know, asking the spirit of these beings for permission before doing anything like that. And, like, I just am so kind of, I don't know, at a loss about how to, I feel the impulse to honor this tree in some way, because it was a nice tree. It was wonderful. It was so tall, and I don't know. I'm so, like, legitimately heartbroken about it for some reason. And I've only been living here for a year, but don't know. It just was like, I guess I've never been around or part of a whole ass tree cutting, let alone having the dang corpse just hanging out in the backyard for days on end. Anyways, sorry. The book that I mentioned that I have been reading and sort of playing with is called Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. And it's by Robert Moss. And it explores specifically the ways in which synchronicity, which we talked about several episodes ago, as being the little baby of Carl Jung, and it's basically when seemingly unrelated events occur in a short span of time. But this book really plays on that concept and asks you to open your mind up to accepting synchronicity in your life and recognize, like, being able, like, honing your skill to be able to recognize it when it's happening. And it talked a lot about how synchronicity is recognized in other cultures, or how it's used in other cultures, and it dived way deeper into Jung's history with synchronicity and what he believed about it. So I learned a lot of cool, interesting things about Carl Jung's, like, freak show life. that was fun. And it, you know, so once you read, like, the history and how to really accept and understand the concept of synchronicity, then he gives you little, like, games, quote-unquote, to play that can kind of, like, bring about synchronicity into your life, kind of manifest it. And one of, like, maybe my favorite thing about it, just coming out of Gemini season, is that he describes synchronicity as being a trickster. It has a lot of trickster energy to it. Oh, so, you know, I just am, I'm loving it. So that is my plug. Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life.
That sounds so cool. Like, yeah, I mean, I would love to hear other perspectives on synchronicity that aren't strictly Jungian perspectives. Like, and it would be fun to have little exercises and things to do with it besides just, like, going about the day, going about the week, and being like, there's that thing again. Cool. You know? As interesting as that is, oftentimes.
Yeah. And, you know, what's, like, sort of fun about it, too, I guess, is that, like, he talks a lot about how the fox is a symbol for synchronicity, and the fox can be, like, a symbol for that trickster energy. And where do I live? But Waukesha, where the name meaning is Little Fox. So I'm hoping that at some point that will help enrichen my synchronistic experience.
Oh, I bet it will.
I hope so. I do have one other plug. I'll try to keep it brief. People look at me like I'm crazy when I mention it. I don't know why. But I have been slowly making my way through all the seasons of The Nanny on HBO Max. I am talking about the one with Fran Drescher. I don't know. It's a great show. I mean, for a Gemini like me, the wit on this show is amazing. The comebacks and the snark and the sarcasm and, like, the rate at which these witticisms are dropped is quality stuff. I highly recommend that if you haven't, like, I don't know, there are people who get all hung up on her voice and whatnot, but, like, her voice is part of the joke, so, you know, just let it wash over you. Just don't be afraid to bathe in the soothing sounds of Fran Drescher's voice.
Spoken like a true Gemini.
So what about you? Have any interesting plugs for this episode?
I am pretty sure I have not plugged or even necessarily mentioned this one in any of our previous episodes, like, I think. And, yeah. So, today, for me, I want to plug an old anime from the 90s that is, I mean, it's still very much alive and well in the cultural mind, like the global cultural mind. It's called Neon Genesis Evangelion. It is an interesting mix of, like, fighting robots and, like, you know, teenagers saving the world, all of those sorts of tropes that are common in some of the anime of either that era or just those particular genres. But it feels relevant, especially to cancer season, because it is Freudian as hell. Everybody has mega family issues, and essentially, like, the show is just this big symbolic allegory for some really, like, deep, unresolved familial traumas, and ultimately, like, this quest for some pretty intense transcendence and healing of just, like, the pain of being alive. So, it's on Netflix. There's a lot to be said about the dub being especially terrible, and the sub being especially terrible compared to previous iterations also. You know, I'm the kind of person who always wants to watch the subtitled version just because I like hearing the Japanese language and I like making those associations, you know? So I'm not trying to, like, ride any high horse or anything on that particular issue. So, yeah. That, and the soundtrack has some pretty damn awesome bangers. Like, the anime style of its era is very pretty. Like, I highly recommend it.
Nice. I mean, I've heard you talk about it before. Go ahead.
You will have a bad time. Like, that's kind of the brilliance of the show, is, like, it starts off in this, like, kind of intense, like, hinting at how deep and fucked up it is, and just keeps getting weirder and weirder and weirder until the, like, last few episodes, where it's just like, man, it, like, you'll be identifying with the characters and feeling your own unresolved trauma, and just, like, there's also, it's set in the future relative to the 90s, so it's set in 2015. And, I mean, even that, so much can be seen as an allegory for, like, hey, we're about to be living on an uninhabitable planet, and we have so little time to get our shit together. Pair that with everybody's personal, like, issues. You're gonna feel bad. But it could be a healing trajectory.
Thanks for the disclaimer, I suppose.
You're welcome.
Would you describe it as a cerebral property? Like, is it a cerebral watch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it fools you at the beginning, like I said, because it has so many just, like, stereotypical anime things going on, and it's real playful in some parts of the episode, and then gets real serious, and then it's, again, over the span of 25 episodes, but by the end, it just gets more and more cerebral, and more just like, what the fuck is really going on here?
Have you ever delved into, like, what the creators were going for?
Honestly, I have avoided that, and I want to one day. It's mostly just been watching it and rewatching it and rewatching it, and then hearing some other people who've watched it a lot and their interpretations of what was going on, and, like, you know, it, whether or not what they were going for was exactly what was going on there, like, there are some elements that do seem to make pretty good sense once you see it enough times and, like, see, like, how it all fits together, like, what specifically, like, in the, like, script itself, not the symbology necessarily, Like, because even, like, what is literally happening is pretty fucking weird and involves some, like, weird machine-human melding kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, I mean, I respect that decision to not not dive into what the creators were going for necessarily, but just continue to rely on your own interpretation of it, or, like, that communal interpretation. That seems like a more fun route to go anyways.
I mean, I'm going to try. TBH, I have heard that the creator is mostly evasive in trying, you know, in answering those sorts of questions. Maybe that's not accurate, but I think that has played into it, too. I don't want to listen to him just be like, eh, it's whatever you want it to be. Like, eh, fine.
Fair enough. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. I don't think I'm going to be watching that anytime soon, to be honest. But, you know, what with my busy schedule of trying to read Sidewalk Oracles and watching The Nanny.
That sounds like a lot more fun, TBH.
Well, in the meantime, we'll be back next week with the quote-unquote fun episode. We'll talk about, you know, famous cancers you might know. Melanoma does not make the list, so don't bring your magnifying glass and mirror. Leave the dermatologist at home. sorry, that's not funny. Cancer is no laughing matter. We'll talk about occupations, common occupations that we often see cancers in, and we'll do our speed round list of questions to find out if cancer enjoys pineapple on their pizza. They don't. And in the meantime, please, if you haven't already, like and follow us. We are on Facebook and Instagram. You can shoot us an email at thegemandipodcast@gmail.com. And as always, thank you for listening. The Gemini Podcast is written and researched by both me and Alice. All of our sound production and editing is done by Alice Alistair, and all of our music, including our theme, comes from Uncertainty, Alice's one-of-a-kind solo act. Alice is also available for personalized natal chart readings. To learn more about availability and rates, reach out to us at thegemandipodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay curious, stargazers.